Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, should smokers be subsidised out of the public purse to be screened for lung cancer? The US government's about to do that, should we? E-cigarettes, those electrical cigar-shaped things that burn vapour and can be used by anyone of any age and are promoted as a safe alternative to real cigarettes. Is the lolly water they vaporise safe? Maybe not, say researchers. And a survey to be released today gives a sobering view on how antibiotics are being prescribed in Australian hospitals. And also today, they're launching a standard for GPs and other doctors to follow, which aims to raise the incredibly low levels of appropriateness of antibiotic prescribing by doctors. It's an incredibly important issue, given the potential for side effects and antibiotic resistance. One of the people heavily involved in both the survey and the clinical standard is Associate Professor Karen Thursky, who's director of the new National Centre for Antimicrobial Stewardship at the Doherty Centre in Melbourne, and an infectious diseases physician at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. And when I spoke to her last night on the programme, I asked her just what is antibiotic stewardship?
Antibiotic stewardship is all about introducing a set of measures to improve antibiotic prescribing. For the layperson, that might be as simple as making sure that a patient gets the right antibiotic for the right indication and avoiding associated toxicities, improving their outcomes. And at the same time, trying to stave off the emergence of antibiotic resistance.
And a lot of the focus has been in hospitals. And we're going to talk about two things today in this story. One is this survey, an antimicrobial, i.e. antibiotic prescribing survey in hospitals. But also tomorrow you're launching what's called a clinical standard, which sounds very bureaucratic, but it's actually quite important. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Tell me about this survey.
Really what we are trying to get is a good snapshot of exactly how antibiotics are being used in hospitals. There really wasn't a standardised way to actually collect this data in terms of demonstrating whether they were compliant with our national guidelines. Australia is very fortunate that we have our therapeutic guidelines. There aren't many countries around the world that have a comprehensive book like the therapeutic guidelines.
So just to explain, this is a little booklet that GPs and doctors can use for prescribing. If you've got a tissue infection in your hand, they'll tell you what the right antibiotic is, for example.
That's right. And then the second thing, which I think was very novel, and this really hasn't been attempted internationally very much, and that's actually to look at appropriateness. So the survey that we are releasing was across around 151 hospitals. And so we're really talking about quite a huge number of prescriptions, 13,000 prescriptions that we were able to look at.
And while hospitals might seem esoteric to the average person listening, this is, of course, where the cutting edge is, where you've got a lot of sick people whose immune systems aren't working well, who are on cancer therapy. And if you're going to get resistance, it could be disastrous, as it indeed has in many hospitals around the country, where you get these resistant organisms and the medical staff run out of antibiotics to use.
Yes, so all of us are now experiencing it.
So what did you find?
Well, very importantly, we're still finding that doctors are still not writing down why they've started an antibiotic. So we found that the indication documentation was only in 70.9% or 71%. So, you know, up to 30% of the time when we are doing these audits, we don't actually know why that antibiotic started. The second most important thing, which I think is a real target for our programs moving into the future, is that there is a strong tendency for surgical teams to continue the antibiotic that they give prior to the surgery, which is, of course, very important for beyond 24 hours. So really, the best practice would be in less than 5% that this actually occurs. However, we found in our survey that it occurred in over 40% of surgeries reported in the survey.
Sorry, so what occurred? They used the antibiotics too long?
They use these surgical prophylaxis for more than 24 hours.
So what we're talking about here is the best surgical practice for many procedures is that you give antibiotics beforehand to prevent infection afterwards, but it's going on too long. And I suppose the average person listening to this would say, well, you know, I've been told by my doctor, if you start the antibiotic, you've got to go on for 7 days, you can't stop it early. And that's a bit of a myth, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. There really is no evidence for what we call extended surgical prophylaxis. And it really just exposes the patient to unnecessary antibiotics, which may be related to antibiotic diarrhea or other toxicities, but also If you consider that surgical prophylaxis is actually the most common reason for antibiotics in our hospital system, you can imagine that if this is happening on a large scale, it will be contributing to very significant overuse of antibiotics. And really, this is the issue. I should remind you that actually 80% of all antibiotics are used in the community, not in hospitals. But in terms of hospitals where the patients are sicker, this is a very important target for our interventions. And I guess the other major finding was that in terms of compliance with our national guidelines, this occurred in around about 60% of the total prescriptions.
And this is about the kind of antibiotic you use in a situation.
Yes, really the choice, how you use it, whether it was too broad a spectrum, whether it was continued too long.
So was this that they were using too sophisticated an antibiotic where a simpler one would do, and therefore you could keep the newer, more potent ones, or ones where there's less resistance, for where it counts?
Exactly right.
So they don't really understand what bugs are around in the hospital.
Yes, there is a large knowledge gap. Prescribing an antibiotic is no simple feat. It is not like writing up, you know, a gram of Panadol four times a day. It is very complex. You need to take into account that there are many different types and classes of antibiotics. There are many different organisms that you need to understand, not only to interpret what the organism is, but its sensitivity profile to antibiotics. And then there are all the various patient factors that influence whether or not the antibiotics are the correct choice, particularly with regards to allergies or toxicity. So it is complex, and that's why it never surprises me to see that audits of antibiotic prescribing across the world lead to a quarter to a half of all prescriptions being inappropriate. It means that we need to have guidelines available. There needs to be policies to oversee how doctors use antibiotics in the hospital. And that might be things like having an approval system to ensure that we can understand who and
so,
why.
So this approval system exists already. There's hospitals like the Austin in Melbourne and others have a system where a junior doctor is not allowed to prescribe a certain antibiotic unless he or she phones up the infectious disease registrar.
Australia is actually a leader in approval systems. So Guidance, which is the system that we developed out of the Royal Melbourne Hospital, we've actually implemented that across four states, up to 60 hospitals now. And it's been very, very successful. So I think the model in hospitals is pretty well defined now, and in fact has become one of the hospital accreditations standards.
So, now, another one you find is just briefly is that the documentation was poorer in private hospitals. And given that private hospitals do a vast volume of hospital workload in Australia these days, that's a bit troubling.
It is, and we've done some very interesting work with the Epworth Hospital, where we have one of our PhD fellows who's done quite a bit of work, both on knowledge and attitudes around antibiotic prescribing. And stewardship as a term was really not well understood by staff within the private hospital at all. Many private hospitals are actually doing very well. They're actually included in these national accreditation standards. So they're having to implement exactly the same processes that's happening in the public hospital. But I guess there are few years behind.
I'm talking to Karen Thirsky, who's releasing the antibiotic prescribing practice and survey. And also tomorrow, Karen, you're releasing a new clinical standard for antibiotic prescribing, because we're talking about hospitals. It's GPs who prescribe most antibiotics in Australia.
Yes, we do know that Australians are huge consumers of antibiotics. And when you look at figures compared to Europe, we really are considered as one of the highest consumers in the world. They tend to present figures as so-called defined daily doses. This is really a unit measure of antibiotics, just to allow sort of international benchmarking. If you look at, say, for example, very low users like Denmark, Netherlands and Sweden, which use around about 15 per 1,000 population per day, Australia is up around 23 per 1,000 population per day.
And they're not dying like flies in Scandinavia, so there's something going
on. That's exactly right. And it's a combination of things. I think it obviously relates to how we practice medicine in the community, but also about consumer expectations to have antibiotics. And so these clinical care standards, which have been released by the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare, are very important. And they do actually provide a very patient-focused approach to what patients should expect when they see a prescriber. So that will encompass both community as well as hospital prescribing. And it also defines a set of quality statements that govern how doctors will be expected to prescribe an antibiotic.
So unlike most standards that the Safety and Quality Commission put out, I mean, most people listening to us would never have heard of it, but these are standards by which hospitals, both private and public, need to subscribe to. But this is actually an onus on the individual doctor.
Yes, it's fantastic.
How does it work for consumers?
Well, at a very basic level, if a patient comes in, for example, into the emergency department, it is expected that doctor seeing them will assess them quickly and provide them with antibiotics, particularly if it's a life-threatening condition, within a certain period of time. And we already have programs like the Sepsis Kills program, where antibiotics should be given within 60 minutes, for example. But also coming down to things like making sure that specimens are taken before an antibiotic is started. That's quite common in hospitals, but actually in general practice in community, it often doesn't happen. And the reason why that's important is that in this day and age where we are starting to see some more resistant bacteria in the community, it is an expectation that the patient gets the right antibiotic, particularly if they happen to have had acquired a resistant bug. And if they don't take a specimen before, then the doctor is perhaps unable to review that, and the patient may in fact end up on an antibiotic that may be too narrow of a spectrum, or alternatively, if they've been put on a broad spectrum, can narrow it down to a narrow spectrum antibiotic.
And if a specimen's negative, you can stop the antibiotic.
And that's exactly right. The other thing is, which I think will be very important, is an expectation that the doctors will explain to the patient why they're on the antibiotic, why they've chosen that antibiotic, and how long they need to take them for, potential side effects.
But what about the conversation which is, I don't need the antibiotic, and the consumer knowing that and the GP not feeling under pressure to prescribe it?
Yes, so this is a less common situation in hospitals.
But it's hugely
it's common
in general
community.
Practice.
It's extremely common, and there are interventions which are very successful in reducing antibiotic use, such as conversations about a delayed prescription. So I'll give you the script, but only fill it if you feel worse. Or indeed, I'm not going to give you a script today, but let's review you in a couple of days' time. The patient needs to understand that for many infections, particularly upper respiratory tract infections, where inappropriate prescribing is still very high, you know, 40% or so, that it is okay to actually, you know, not have antibiotics straight away.
But I thought the figure was even worse than that. I thought that, according to the appropriateness study from the University of New South Wales, only 19% of antibiotic prescribing in Australian general practice is appropriate.
Yes, so there are lots of different audits of respiratory tract infections. That has been one of the key areas that the National Prescribing Service has been looked at, that is looking at. And in fact, even in our NAP survey, the national survey, it was a very similar figure in hospital patients where overuse of antibiotics is very common for conditions that wouldn't normally need antibiotics, and that will need to be a key focus.
Now, the government spent millions on the National Prescribing Service to change antibiotic prescribing. I understand it hasn't budged.
There were some early wins, and then it sort of has seemed to plateau out. And so there are some important initiatives. Our team at the Doherty in Royal Melbourne have just been awarded a $2.5 million grant through the NHMRC to create a One Health Centre where we'll be working with both animal and human sectors to look at what are the drivers of prescribing. But in terms of community and general practice prescribing, we need a lot more information. What are the current attitudes that are influencing, both from a prescriber but also from the patient point of view? And then what are some of the strategies to guide point-of-care prescribing that would be acceptable to GPs? We don't have a lot of point-of-care tests, for example. It'd be fantastic to have a test that could tell a GP quickly whether the patient has a virus or a bacterial infection.
Karen Thursky, thanks for joining us on the Health Report.
Thanks very much, Norman.
Associate Professor Karen Thursky is director of the new National Centre for Antimicrobial Stewardship at the Doherty Centre in Melbourne, and she's also an infectious diseases physician at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. And you're listening to the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. A paper in the current edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association sounds a serious note of warning about e-cigarettes, which are being promoted as a safe alternative to real cigarettes. In Australia, e-cigarettes are largely unregulated, apart from manufacturers not being allowed to use nicotine in the vaporizer or to make therapeutic claims. So what's used instead is a flavoured liquid, which could harbour serious risk. Jessica Barrington-Trimmis is in the Department of Preventive Medicine at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles.
The way that they generally work is that there's a liquid solution that you put into a tank That's vaporized, and you are smoking the vapor from the liquid solution.
And what you're concerned about, whilst there's a debate about quitting and the use of nicotine in e-cigarettes, which is not allowed in Australia, you're concerned about the use of flavourings.
Right. The issue of nicotine is one that people can debate about. There's a huge public health debate, as you know, with some people saying, well, these products, these electronic cigarettes, may help smokers to stop using combustible cigarettes. And if these electronic cigarettes are safer than regular cigarettes, then that's a good thing. On the other hand, especially with these e-cigarettes that contain nicotine, if there are kids using these things that never would have used regular cigarettes, then we're potentially introducing a whole new generation of nicotine-addicted users.
So the implication there is that e-cigarettes could be a transitional product that leads to cigarette smoking, but also in parallel, you've got e-cigarettes which have, the marketers would say, harmless liquids in them which give you a flavour like vanilla or apple or something like that.
Right. Our research over here is looking at actually both of those things. So on the one hand, the JAMA piece is bringing up this issue of flavorings in electronic cigarettes beyond just the nicotine aspect of them and beyond the fact that these flavorings are being used to market to adolescents. The actual flavoring, the actual liquid solution that you breathe into your lungs every time you use an e-cigarette could contain some potential respiratory toxins that may be very damaging to the lungs.
And you've looked at what they could be, and what have you found?
So this is just the commentary. We haven't fully explored this issue in our own data, but just sort of wrote this piece more to bring up the issue and make the public health community aware that this may be an issue.
So what are your concerns?
We're concerned that there are chemicals in these e-cigarette flavorings that are used to give that nice vanilla flavor or other sweet flavor that are respiratory toxins and may therefore cause respiratory damage to people who are using electronic cigarettes.
Such as?
The two that we bring up in our paper are diacetyl and 2,3-pentanedione. Diacetyl is a chemical that is used to give like a buttery or creamy flavoring to food. In the United States, the Flavoring Extract Manufacturers Association and the FDA have approved this chemical for ingestion. They found that it's not unsafe when you eat it. The problem is that even though this chemical is safe for ingestion, it's extremely harmful to the lungs when inhaled. And so in light of this, some people have looked at different substitutes for diacetyl, including 2,3-pentanedione, 2,3-hexanedione, 2,3-heptanedione, which, as you can probably guess, have a very similar chemical structure to diacetyl. And recent literature has shown that these chemicals are as toxic to the lung as diacetyl is. So even if they're using the substitute flavoring in these e-cigarettes and e-cigarette manufacturers are claiming that their products are diacetyl-free, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're safe because these substitutes may be as damaging.
And the evidence for this comes from animal studies or human studies?
It comes from a bunch of different places. So there have been animal studies that have looked specifically at diacetyl and 2,3-pentanedione. The human studies, probably the most compelling evidence, are some research that we're looking at exposures to flavoring manufacturers. These are people working in plants where they are manufacturing these different types of flavorings, including butter flavoring for microwave popcorn and some other more buttery, creamy flavorings as well. And they found, you know, a huge incidence of this disease, bronchiolitis brand, which is a severe lung disease that is the result of diacetyl. And so the incidence of that among flavor manufacturing workers is high.
So how come the Food and Drug Administration hasn't dealt with this in a regulatory fashion?
In terms of e-cigarettes, because they don't have any jurisdiction over them right now. Right now, in the United States at least, the e-cigarette liquid is completely unregulated. They're in the process of trying to get the authority to regulate these products.
And presumably these are the same products, the same liquids that go into hookah pipes in these bars that often underage kids go into and smoke hookahs without marijuana in them, but nonetheless they have these flavorings in them.
Yes.
So you've been studying regulation. What do you think should happen with these cigarettes?
Well, I think at this point we really just need more research to really hammer out all of these issues and figure out exactly what's going on.
Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Sure, thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Barrington-Trimmis is in the Department of Preventive Medicine at the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. Last week, Medicare in the United States announced it was going to fund what's called CT scan screening for lung cancer in high-risk smokers. This has been a controversial issue around the world. People have argued over the evidence on whether it's effective, and there's been moralising. Since smokers have brought this on themselves, we should let them burn, so to speak. What should we do in Australia? Well, with me in the studio is Professor Ian Olver, who's Chief Executive of Cancer Council Australia. Welcome to the program, Ian.
Thanks, Norman.
Let's just, before we get on to CT scanning of the lung, let's talk about e-cigarettes. Does Cancer Council Australia have a position on them?
Well, we share the concerns that the components of the vapor just simply haven't been tested in many cases, so we don't know how safe e-cigarettes are or whether they'll actually lead people to smoking conventional cigarettes.
So do you believe they should be regulated or what? Or studied?
We believe they should be further studied and regulated until we have evidence as to whether they're safe or not.
What is the story with CT scanning for lung cancer in smokers?
An American study showed that there could be a survival advantage up to about 20% if low-dose CT scanning of smokers that smoked heavily, that was 30 pack years a day, particularly in the over 55-year-olds, and that's what the recommendation is based on. However, that has to be balanced against a number of downsides to it, which is why there's controversy over funding this type of screening.
If I remember rightly, the controversy is that when you do the CT scanning of the lung, you find things in the lung which you were never meant to see and you don't know what it means.
Well, that's right. You find little nodules, and what's been found is the false positive rate, in other words, nodules that aren't cancer, is very, very high with this scanning, because most infections, particularly things like TB or mycoplasma, will end up leaving a little nodule. And so what happens is you pick up the nodule and the next thing you have to start investigating it further to see if it is cancer or not. And so people may have invasive attempts at biopsy or serial further scans. So it's not as easy as being able to say definitively that a nodule is cancer.
Are lung cancers like, say, bowel cancer or even breast cancer where there is a precancerous nodule?
No, that's not necessarily a precancerous nodule. I mean, they've got to start from something. We're trying to distinguish here largely between benign nodules, the residual of other diseases like infections or sarcoidosis or a disease like that that cause nodules, and ones that are cancerous, which will eventually grow and spread.
And is it like ovarian cancer where you suspect it, you've really got to operate and find out what it is, or are there scans that can help you find out what the nature of the nodule is likely to be?
Over time, you might be able to measure the volumes that may help to distinguish between a cancerous nodule and a benign one, but it all requires follow-up, and you'd rather like a screening test to be far more accurate and not have this 96-plus percent false positive rate. And even if it is cancerous, there are some cancers that won't actually cause the patient a problem in their lifetime because they're very slow growing, or other diseases in that age group will be what affects their life.
So it's not just the cost of the CT scan, it's the cost of the other investigations, not to mention the anxiety while you wait to find the result.
That's right. There's anxiety that you may have cancer, and then there's the other tests you have to do. And even if you're worried about exposing people to excess x-rays, particularly those that had benign lesions, it's calculated that a low-dose CT scan is like having about 10 x-rays. But if you keep having to do it to investigate whether a nodule is growing to try and determine which ones are cancer, you might end up with a lot more radiation exposure than you're expecting. So you've got things like the psychological problems, the radiation exposure, and simply over-investigating someone and over-diagnosing cancers that may never cause a problem.
So it's a pretty heroic decision on the part of US Medicare.
Oh, look, I think it is at this stage. We'd like a lot more information about the group that would be best screened by this. In other words, it may not just be how much the consumption of cigarettes they've had, but it may be whether they've had other lung diseases, whether they've got a family history. You may be able to define a better group to screen. And we'd like a more accurate test. And of course, the other thing is when you spend money on that, you've got to say, is that the thing that you could spend money on that will reduce the death rate from lung cancer the most? And I think you'd clearly have to compare it against spending further money on tobacco control, which is still the thing that will decrease the incidence and the death rate from lung cancer the most. So you've got an opportunity cost there.
But nonetheless, people are going to develop lung cancer. It's still, I think, last time I looked, the number one killer, even though it's declining in rates in Australia, for a number one cancer killer, and short prognosis. So people are going to get it. Well, why shouldn't we invest in dealing with it better?
Well, look, I think over time it would be great to have a screening test for lung cancer, but I think we need to know a little bit more about it. We've had one big American trial. There are a couple of trials ongoing where we may actually find out some more information about what the best group to screen is and whether we can make it more accurate by measuring the volume of the nodules and whether that'll give us a better handle on which ones are cancerous or not. So I think we're suggesting maybe it's a little bit premature on the information we've got, but the final goal of being able to screen a high-risk group would be very laudable if it decreases the death rate.
So what's a smoker to look out for?
Where treatment can make an impact is very early lung cancer, and the ones that do best are actually ones that are found incidentally when people are being investigated for something else. You'd really want to try and get it before someone had extreme symptoms, either coughing up blood or pain or breathlessness. With smokers, they may well have those symptoms because of chronic lung disease caused by smoking, so it can be very difficult for them to detect an early cancer, which is why there's a big push to try and see whether we can screen successfully.
Now, we don't necessarily uniformly perform as well as some areas overseas in the treatment of lung cancer. In other words, people who could survive are not necessarily surviving and being treated effectively.
Look, I think we have all the treatments. I think the thing we've got to make sure of is that those patients with early lung cancer are offered treatment, and there's no sort of nihilism about saying, oh, this is lung cancer, it still doesn't do very well, therefore we won't treat it. In fact, the early lung cancers can do very well. It's the later ones where symptomatic control seems to be about the best that can be offered.
And it's not necessarily obvious from your first X-ray. You've got to have special tests like PET scanning to find out what the true nature of it is. So the implication is you've got to be referred to a specialist centre that deals with lung cancer.
Yeah, I think that's right. Instead of a presumptive diagnosis and saying, well, it doesn't do very well and there's not very good treatments, a referral to a specialist centre with a multidisciplinary team where a decision about whether a definitive local treatment like surgery or even radiotherapy could have curative intent needs to be made. And some of those patients can do very well.
So you've just got to be sure about where your GP or specialist refers you, particularly if you live in the country.
I think that's right. I think we know that rural patients don't do quite as well as those in the city, and that may be due to two factors. They're not as easily investigated because they've got to travel often for specialist scans, and sometimes they have to travel for specialist referrals. So sometimes they miss out on being referred in the first place.
Ian Olver, thanks for joining us on the program.
My pleasure, thank you.
Ian Olver is Chief Executive of Cancer Council Australia, and you've been listening to The Health Report with me, Norman Swan. I'll see you next time.
Mary Nolan's a farmer, and if you've ever attended Victoria's Meredith Music Festival, then you've danced in one of her paddocks.
I think Leonard Cohen's line, there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. I keep coming back to that. Often it comes back to me.
But Mary's also one of Australia's foremost advocates for people with brain injuries, and it's all the result of some deep cracks in her own life. A Day in the Life of Mary Nolan, and you can download or stream this encounter from the RN website.